Chapter 36. I were not afraid of wounding your chivalrous feelings, for which, by the by, women are not so grateful as you may think, to fellows of your kind. Upon my word, Marlowe, I cried, what are you flying out at me for like this? I wouldn't use an ill-sounding word about women, but what right have you to imagine that I am looking for gratitude? Marlowe raised a soothing hand. There. There. I take back the ill-sounding word, with the remark, though, that cynicism seems to me a word invented by hypocrites. But let that pass. As to women, they know that the clamor for opportunities for them to become something which they cannot be is as reasonable as if mankind at large started asking for opportunities of winning immortality in this world, in which death is the very condition of life. You must understand that I am not talking here of material existence. That naturally is implied, but you won't maintain that a woman who, say, enlisted, for instance, there have been cases, has conquered her place in the world. She has only got her living in it, which is quite meritorious, but not quite the same thing. All these reflections which arise from my picking up the thread of Florida Barrel's existence did not, I am certain, present themselves to Mr. Powell, not the Mr. Powell we know taking solitary weekend cruises in the estuary of the Thames with mysterious stashes in two lonely creeks, but to the young Mr. Powell, the chance second officer of the ship Ferndale, commanded and for the most part owned by Roderick Anthony, the son of the poet you know. A Mr. Powell, much slenderer than our robust friend is now, with the bloom of innocence not quite rubbed off his smooth cheeks, and apt not only to be interested, but also to be surprised by the experience life was holding in store for him. This would account for his remembering so much of it with considerable vividness. For instance, the impressions attending his first breakfast on board the Ferndale, both visual and mental, were as fresh to him as if received yesterday. The surprise, it is easy to understand, would arise from the inability to interpret aright the signs which experience, a thing mysterious in itself, makes to our understanding and emotions. For it is never more than that. Our experience never gets into our blood and bones. It always remains outside of us. That's why we look with wonder at the past. And this persists even when from practice, and through growing callousness of fiber we come to the point when nothing that we meet in that rapid blinking stumble across a flick of sunshine which our life is nothing, I say, which we run against surprises us anymore. Not at the time, I mean. If, later on, we recover the faculty with some such exclamation. Well, I'll be hanged if I ever, ... It is probably because this very thing, that there should be a past to look back upon, other people's, is very astounding in itself, when one has the time, a fleeting and immense instant to think of it. I was on the point of interrupting Marlowe, when he stopped of himself, his eyes fixed on vacancy, or perhaps I wouldn't be too hard on him, on a vision. He has the habit, or, say, the fault, of defective mantelpiece clocks, of suddenly stopping in the very fullness of the tick. If you have ever lived with a clock afflicted with that perversity, you know how vexing it is such a stoppage. I was vexed with Marlowe. He was smiling faintly while I waited. He even laughed a little. And then I said acidly, am I to understand that you have ferreted out something comic in the history of Florida Barrel? Comic, he exclaimed. Oh, what makes you say, ... I laughed, did I? But don't you know that people laugh at absurdities that are very far from being comic? Didn't you read the latest books about laughter written by philosophers, psychologists? There is a lot of them. I dare say there has been a lot of nonsense written about laughter and tears too, for that matter, I said impatiently. They say, pursued the unabashed Marlowe, that we laugh from a sense of superiority. Therefore, observe, simplicity, honesty, warmth of feeling, delicacy of heart and of conduct, self-confidence, magnanimity are laughed at, because the presence of these traits in a man's character often puts him in too difficult, cruel or absurd situations, and makes us, the majority who are fairly free as a rule from these peculiarities, feel pleasantly superior. Speak for yourself, I said. But have you discovered all these fine things in the story, or has Mr. Powell discovered them to you in his artless talk? Have you two been having good healthy laughs together? Come. Are your sides aching yet, Marlowe? Marlowe took no offense at my banter. He was quite serious. I should not like to say offhand how much of that there was, he pursued with amusing caution. But there was a situation, tense enough for the signs of it to give many surprises to Mr. Powell, neither of them shocking in itself, but with a cumulative effect which made the whole unforgettable in the detail of its progress. And the first surprise came very soon, when the explosives, to which he owed his sudden chance of engagement, dynamite in cases, and blasting powder in barrels taken on board, main hatch patent for sea, cook restored to his functions in the galley, anchor fished and the tug ahead, rounding the south for land, and with the sun sinking clear, and red down the purple vista of the channel, he went on the poop, on duty, it is true, but with time to take the first freer breath in the busy day of departure. The pilot was still on board, who gave him first a silent glance, and then passed an insignificant remark, before resuming his lounging to and fro between the steering wheel and the binnacle. Powell took his station modestly at the break of the poop. He had noticed across the skylight a head in a gray cap. But when, after a time, he crossed over to the other side of the deck, he discovered that it was not the captain's head at all. He became aware of gray hairs curling over the nape of the neck. How could he have made that mistake? But on board ship away from the land, one does not expect to come upon a stranger. Powell walked past the man. A thin, somewhat sunken face, with a tightly closed mouth, stared at the distant French coast, vague like a suggestion of solid darkness, lying abeam beyond the evening light reflected from the level waters, themselves growing more somber than the sky, a stare, across which Powell had to pass, and did pass with a quick side glance, noting its immovable stillness. His passage disturbed those eyes no more than if he had been as immaterial as a ghost. And this failure of his person in producing an impression affected him strangely. Who could that old man be? He was so curious that he even ventured to ask the pilot in a low voice. The pilot turned out to be a good-natured specimen of his kind, condescending, sententious. He had been down to his meals in the main cabin and had something to impart. That? Queer fish, eh? Mrs. Anthony's father. I've been introduced to him in the cabin at breakfast time. Name of Smith. Wonder if he has all his wits about him. They take him about with them, it seems. Don't look very happy, eh? Then, changing his tone abruptly, he desired Powell to get all hands on deck and make sail on the ship. She'll be leaving you in half an hour. You'll have plenty of time to find out all about the old gent, he added with a thick laugh. In the secret emotion of giving his first order as a fully responsible officer, young Powell forgot the very existence of that old man in a moment. The following days, in the interest of getting in touch with the ship, with the men in her, with his duties, in the rather anxious period of settling down, his curiosity slumbered. For of course the pilot's few words had not extinguished it. This settling down was made easy for him by the friendly character of his immediate superior, the chief. Powell could not defend himself from some sympathy for that thick, bald man, comically shaped, with his crimson complexion, and something pathetic in the rolling of his very movable black eyes in an apparently immovable head, who was so tactfully ready to take his competency for granted. There can be nothing more reassuring to a young man tackling his life's work for the first time. Mr. Powell, his mind at ease about himself, had time to observe the people around with friendly interest. Very early in the beginning of the passage, he had discovered with some amusement that the marriage of Captain Anthony was resented by those to whom Powell, conscious of being looked upon as something of an outsider, referred in his mind as the old lot. ... They had the funny, regretful glances, intonations, nods of men who had seen other, better times. What difference it could have made to the bosun and the carpenter Powell could not very well understand. Yet these two pulled long faces, and even gave hostile glances to the poop. The cook and the steward might have been more directly concerned. But the steward used to remark on occasion, "Oh, she gives no extra trouble," with scrupulous fairness of the most gloomy kind. He was rather a silent man with a great sense of his personal worth which made his speeches guarded. The cook, a neat man with fair side whiskers, who had been only 3 years in the ship, seemed the least concerned. He was even known to have inquired once or twice as to the success of some of his dishes with the captain's wife. This was considered a sort of disloyal falling away from the ruling feeling. The mate's annoyance was yet the easiest to understand. As he let it out to Powell before the first week of the passage was over, "You can't expect me to be pleased at being chucked out of the saloon, as if I weren't good enough, to sit down to meet with that woman." But he hastened to add, "Don't you think I'm blaming the captain? He isn't a man to be found fault with. You, Mr. Powell, are too young yet to understand such matters." Some considerable time afterwards, at the end of a conversation of that aggrieved sort, he enlarged a little more by repeating, "Yes, you are too young to understand these things. I don't say you haven't plenty of sense. You are doing very well here. Jolly sight better than I expected, though I liked your looks from the first." It was in the trade winds, at night, under a velvety, bespangled sky, a great multitude of stars watching the shadows of the sea gleaming mysteriously in the wake of the ship, while the leisurely swishing of the water to leeward was like a drowsy comment on her progress. Mr. Powell expressed his satisfaction by a half-bashful laugh. The mate mused on, "And of course you haven't known the ship as she used to be. She was more than a home to a man. She was not like any other ship, and Captain Anthony was not like any other master to sail with. Neither is she now. But before one never had a care in the world, as to her, and as to him too. No, indeed, there was never anything to worry about." Young Powell couldn't see what there was to worry about even then. The serenity of the peaceful night seemed as vast as all space, and as enduring as eternity itself. It's true the sea is an uncertain element, but no sailor remembers this in the presence of its bewitching power any more than a lover ever thinks of the proverbial inconstancy of women. And Mr. Powell, being young, thought naively that the captain being married, there could be no occasion for anxiety as to his condition. I suppose that to him life, perhaps not so much his own as that of others, was something still in the nature of a fairy tale with a they lived happy ever after termination. We are the creatures of our light literature much more than is generally suspected in a world which prides itself on being scientific and practical, and in possession of incontrovertible theories. Powell felt in that way the more, because the captain of a ship at sea is a remote, inaccessible creature, something like a prince of a fairy tale, alone of his kind, depending on nobody, not to be called to account except by powers practically invisible and so distant that they might well be looked upon as supernatural for all that the rest of the crew knows of them, as a rule. So he did not understand the aggrieved attitude of the mate, or rather he understood it obscurely as a result of simple causes which did not seem to him adequate. He would have dismissed all this out of his mind with a contemptuous, "What the devil do I care?" If the captain's wife herself had not been so young, to see her the first time had been something of a shock to him. He had some preconceived ideas as to captains' wives which, while he did not believe the testimony of his eyes, made him open them very wide. He had stared till the captain's wife noticed it plainly and turned her face away. Captain's wife. That girl covered with rugs, in a long chair. Captain's. ... He gasped mentally. It had never occurred to him that a captain's wife could be anything but a woman, to be described as stout or thin, as jolly or crabbed, but always mature, and even, in comparison with his own years, frankly old. But this. It was a sort of moral upset, as though he had discovered a case of abduction, or something as surprising as that. You understand that nothing is more disturbing than the upsetting of a preconceived idea. Each of us arranges the world according to his own notion of the fitness of things. To behold a girl, where your average mediocre imagination had placed a comparatively old woman, may easily become one of the strongest shocks. Marlowe paused, smiling to himself. Powell remained impressed after all these years by the very recollection. He continued in a voice, amused perhaps but not mocking. He said to me only the other day with something like the first awe of that discovery lingering in his tone, he said to me, "Why, she seemed so young, so girlish, that I looked round for some woman which would be the captain's wife, though of course I knew there was no other woman on board that voyage. The voyage before, it seems, there had been the steward's wife, to act as maid to Mrs. Anthony, but she was not taken, that time for some reason he didn't know. Mrs. Anthony. ... If it hadn't been the captain's wife, he would have referred to her mentally as a kid, he said. I suppose there must be a sort of divinity hedging in a captain's wife, however incredible, which prevented him applying to her that contemptuous definition in the secret of his thoughts. I asked him when this had happened, and he told me that it was 3 days after parting from the tug. Just outside the channel to be precise. A headwind had set in with unpleasant damp weather. He had come up to leeward of the poop, still feeling very much of a stranger, and an untried officer, at 6 in the evening to take his watch. To see her was quite as unexpected as seeing a vision. When she turned away her head, he recollected himself, and dropped his eyes. What he could see then was only, close to the long chair on which she reclined, a pair of long, thin legs ending in black cloth boots tucked in close to the skylight seat. Whence he concluded that the old gentleman, apostrophe who wore a gray cap like the captain's, was sitting by her his daughter. In his first astonishment he had stopped dead short, with the consequence that now he felt very much abashed at having betrayed his surprise. But he couldn't very well turn tail and bolt off the poop. He had come there on duty. So, still with downcast eyes, he made his way past them. Only when he got as far as the wheel grating did he look up. She was hidden from him by the back of her deck chair, but he had the view of the owner of the thin, aged leg seated on the skylight, his clean-shaved cheek, his thin compressed mouth with a hollow in each corner, the sparse gray locks escaping from under the tweed cap, and curling slightly on the collar of the coat. He leaned forward a little over Mrs. Anthony, but they were not talking. Captain Anthony, walking with a springy hurried gait on the other side of the poop from end to end, gazed straight before him. Young Powell might have thought that his captain was not aware of his presence either. However, he knew better, and for that reason spent a most uncomfortable hour motionless by the compass before his captain stopped in his swift pacing, and with an almost visible effort, made some remark to him about the weather in a low voice. Before Powell, who was startled, could find a word of answer, the captain swung off again on his endless tramp with a fixed gaze. And till the supper bell rang, silence dwelt over that poop like an evil spell. The captain walked up and down looking straight before him, the helmsman steered, looking upwards at the sails, the old gent on the skylight looked down on his daughter, and Mr. Powell confessed to me that he didn't know where to look, feeling as though he had blundered in where he had no business, which was absurd. At last he fastened his eyes on Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.